Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The Reed Green Festival was back on the campus of Salisbury University this week. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Conveying the importance of the environment to children and young adults through literature is the essence of the Green Book Awards given out annually by the Newton Marasco Foundation. And as in years past, in our studio is Ernie Bond. He's Associate Professor of Education at Salisbury University, who's been involved in organizing the festival. Also on hand is Caitlin Vernon. She's author of a young adult nonfiction book entitled Nowhere Else on Earth, Standing Tall for the Great Bear Rainforest. And also Claudia Davila, who is author of Luce Sees the Lights, a graphic novel for children's fiction. And welcome to you all. Well, Ernie, first of all, I want to start with you. And tell me a little bit about the kinds of books that we've been seeing this year in terms of the awards and the young adults and the environment, as opposed to maybe years past. Anything stand out in terms of genre, in terms of what's being emphasized this year, as opposed to maybe years past?
Yeah, really interesting this year. There were more nonfiction books submitted this year than any other category. There's five categories for the awards. There's picture book, children's fiction, young adult fiction, children's nonfiction, and young adult nonfiction. And for whatever reason in the publishing industry this year, it was really heavy emphasis on nonfiction. So we saw a lot of those, and very difficult to choose because there were so many good ones.
Anything stand out? I know you had the awards, but any kinds of things that stood out? Any particular themes?
It was, well, definitely one that stood out in nonfiction was the Nowhere Else on Earth. One of the things about a book like this, which seems to be a very big trend, is to have tidbits of information, boxes of information interspersed throughout the book. So you can read the book straight through and there's a wonderful narrative, but there's also this browsing element that goes on when a lot of young adults are reading nonfiction, where they're looking for particular things in the book that stand out for them, and having those boxes of information that give tidbits that'll grab their attention and get them interested and pull them into the subject is a big trend in nonfiction. That's one thing.
We also have a graphic novel that's been awarded as well. Tell me a little bit about the decision. Is that something you've done before, or what's the situation with
that? There haven't been a lot of graphic novels submitted in the past. And so it was very refreshing, very cool to have one in the children's fiction category. And it really stood out because, of course, graphic novels are one of those formats of literature that will attract a lot of readers who might not necessarily pick up the 300-page novel with full text. The more visual learner, pull them in, get them excited about the topics. And this one was a very cool graphic novel that's easily accessible for third, fourth graders. So that was great to have. And that was in the children's fiction category.
I want to turn out to Caitlin Vernon. She's author of Nowhere Else on Earth, Standing Tall for the Great Bear Rainforest. And tell us first a little bit about where this rainforest is and how you became involved in talking about it.
Sure, yeah. It's the Great Bear Rainforest is on Canada's west coast. So if you go north of Washington State and head up the coast, just before you hit the bottom of the Alaska Panhandle is where you get to the Great Bear Rainforest. It's the world's largest remaining intact coastal temperate rainforest. So ecologically, it's really a global treasure. It's Canada's Amazon. It's Canada's Amazon rainforest. It's got animals like the spirit bears, which are a genetic variation of the black bear that live nowhere else on Earth. Huge trees, rich First Nation cultures. It's quite an amazing part of the world. And I have the great fortune of living in British Columbia and working for the Sierra Club of British Columbia, which takes me up into the Great Bear Rainforest quite often. And the story came to be, the book came to be as a result of listening to the stories from the coast of what people were seeing as far as declining salmon and bears that were hungry and freezers that were empty, because things are changing in our world. And I wanted to help tell some of those stories and do it in a in a way that gives hope and that's inspiring and encourages us all to get involved.
Now, the book utilizes a lot of photographs. Tell me a little bit about it. I mean, where do those photographs come from? How did you assemble this, particularly and mesh it with the text?
It is full of photographs, all color photos. I have, again, the great privilege of knowing a lot of really phenomenal photographers, some of them even National Geographic world-class photographers. And they are all people who have been to the Great Bear Rainforest, who are concerned about protecting this amazing part of the world, and who generously offered to share some of their photos in the book. Some of them are First Nations people who live in the rainforest and are bear viewing guides and so on. So they, more than anyone else, have access to, you know, some of these incredible photos. And I just got lucky.
Now, would you travel around the rainforest, what's your sense about it? We talk about it, you know, in terms of its description and so, but what is the emotional sense you have when you see, for instance, rare species, and when you see these trees that are 1,000, maybe 1,500 years old? I mean, huge compared to, say, trees that we even see here.
The one word that comes to mind is that it's incredibly humbling to gaze into the eyes of a wolf, or to sit in the rain and watch a spirit bear catch a salmon, or to stand under these trees that, you know, were already old when Europeans first stumbled onto the shores of North America. It's very, very humbling. And what it is it reminds us that we as human beings are a part of the natural world. We're not actually separate from the natural world. And so I write about the Great Bear Rainforest because it's a global treasure. It's an amazing place. It's a place I love, and it's a place under threat. But I also write about it because it's kind of a window into reminding us about our place in the natural world. So wherever we live, there are those amazing, humbling features and wildlife and trees and ecosystems and that we're a part of wherever we live. So it's pretty in your face in the Great Bear Rainforest, you know, the wolves and the bears and the big trees. But really, the book is about more than that. It's about paying attention to what is so amazing in the world we live in, and that we're connected to that.
Now, there's obviously also a Native American population. Native Americans, or First Nation, is to say, showed up about 9,000 years ago. Tell me a little bit about their relationship to this rainforest and how you see that interconnected.
Well, I definitely could not presume to speak for the First Nations, but I am fortunate that many of the folks who live in the Great Bear Rainforest and have cultures that do go back at least 9,000, 11,000, basically back as far as glaciation, as they say, they've been there since time before memory. I'm incredibly fortunate that many of them, kids and elders, have chosen to share their stories in the book. And the one thing that I would say is that the cultures are very dependent on cedar trees and on salmon. So salmon in particular are the lifeblood of the rainforest. They bring nutrients from the ocean up into the rainforest every year that feeds the bears, the wolves, the eagles, but also the trees and also the people. And so these rich cultures have dependent on the really abundant salmon resources for thousands of years. And those salmon are in jeopardy these days. So, yeah.
I understand that there have been efforts then to preserve the rainforest there. We had a series of agreements. I mean, reaching back, I guess there were some recommendations in 2004, I think it was, and then again we had some final agreement in 2006. Where does that stand? Because I understand that the 2006 agreement, which the British Columbia government agreed to, that it really didn't go as far as a lot of what scientists wanted. Even the recommendations didn't really go as far as what scientists wanted in terms of protecting the forest.
It's a lot of work has gone into protecting the Great Bear Rainforest for over 10 years, and the agreements, I think, are globally precedent-setting. They're a model that the world can and should kind of look at and emulate elsewhere. Scientists said that, first of all, one third of the region, 2 million hectares, was set aside in protected areas, which is totally unprecedented. I mean, that's huge. And that was led by the First Nations who live there, who wanted to protect those areas. And then the remainder of the area, is to be managed under something called ecosystem-based management, which is a lighter touch, more sustainable way of doing forestry. So it gets us away from this dichotomy of we have parks over here and then industrial resource extraction over here, and it moves us towards a recognition that we do use the natural resources, but let's do it in a way that's more sustainable, that doesn't damage the ecosystems. So in those ecosystem-based management areas, science has said that 70% of the old growth trees need to be protected in order to maintain the health of the rainforest. And we're currently, with new forest regulations, we're at 50%. So there's a bit of a gap. We are, the provincial government has committed to go to the full 70%, but they're dragging their heels a little bit. We have a campaign called Take It Taller. If you go to takeittaller.ca, you can join our campaign and support us in pushing to actually fully implement the Great Bear Rainforest Agreements and reach 70% of old growth protection.
Yeah, no, my understanding, by the way, logging obviously is a threat in this area, and that the predominant way that they log is simply clear cutting, is just wiping these things out. What's going on with that? Is there, in terms of trying to preserve the rainforest on the one hand, and yet we have these logging interests on the other?
Well, this is where it's an interesting model, because it doesn't say we're going to set aside every single tree forever. It says we're still going to do some logging, but we're going to do it differently. So we're going to do it in places, we're going to ensure that we're protecting the wildlife habitat, the bird habitat, we're protecting the salmon habitat, we're protecting enough of the forest to maintain the ecosystem health. And then in the remaining parts, yes, we can still do some forestry, but let's try to do it differently.
Now, going back to the children's book, obviously, you've written this for children. What are children's? I mean, obviously, you see children go up there, and whether it's as tourists or as people who live there, what is their reaction? There was a relationship, do you think, between themselves and this forest, and when they see these huge, particularly these huge. I mean, I've not been where you are, but I did live in California, so I'm familiar with the big redwood.
Trees,
yes,
yeah.
The redwoods, which are enormous. As a matter of fact, as a kid, I remember the 1950s. My family drove through the big giant redwood, in which they cut it out, and you could drive your car literally through, which apparently is now gone. What kind of relationship do you see between children as they gaze at some of these nature's wonders?
I think that it's really important for kids to know, wherever they live in the world, that there are places like this out there. So whether they get the chance to go there or not, to know that there are spirit bears, to know that there are these giant trees, to know that one day they might have the opportunity to go there. Because when you do go, it blows your mind. I mean, it's totally amazing. And children, anybody, really, for example, whales. So it's not just in the Great Bear Rainforest, but up and down the coast. There's something that I noticed, that when you're in a boat and whales come up and surface and jump or show their tail or whatever it is, the whole boat goes quiet. There's some sense of awe, of respect that comes over the boat. And that's not just the kids, that's everybody. And so I think having the opportunity to experience these places and is really important. And even just knowing that they're there is really important.
Can you read a little from your book there, or find a little piece there to,
sure,
to give us a sense of what the book is like there, and what you're conveying to particularly young adults, young readers?
I'll read right from the very beginning of the book, actually. So here's how it starts. A black bear walks into a Subway restaurant in the small town of Kitimat in northern British Columbia. Sounds like the first line of a joke, doesn't it? But it's no joke when the bear jumps over the counter and pokes its nose into the sandwich fixings. You can watch the video online. The young woman working that day hid in the bathroom while the bear sniffed around. After the bear left the Subway, it was shot because people were worried it would come back into town. That's what happens when bears eat sandwiches instead of salmon. This black bear lived in the Great Bear Rainforest on the north coast of British Columbia. The rainforest is a magical place where edible plants, fish from the ocean, and tiny creatures in the soil are all connected. People live among the giant trees too, and whales swim offshore. Wolf pups play with ravens on the beach, and eagles soar overhead, teaching their young to catch fish. Spirit bears roam the forest, their white fur standing out against the many shades of green. Moss grows thick on tree branches, where seabirds have their nests. Slugs and bugs build the rich soil that ancient trees depend on. Salmon travel up the rivers and streams from the ocean into the rainforest. In a good year, grizzly bears will eat so many salmon that their bellies actually drag on the ground. When the bears want to nap after eating so much, they dig pits in the ground to rest their big bellies in. Sounds like a good life, doesn't it? But things are changing in the Great Bear Rainforest.
It, of course, is Caitlin Vernon. She's reading from her new nonfiction book for young adults called Nowhere Else on Earth, Standing Tall for the Great Bear Rainforest. Now I want to turn to another different kind of book. It's actually a graphic novel. It's by Claudia Davila, and it's called Luce Sees the Light. And first of all, Claudia, tell me a little bit about what inspired you to write this book and to create this book for children.
Sure. Well, this book is basically about living more locally, more sustainably, and focusing more on family, community, and neighborhoods instead of reaching out so much to imports, basically, and high energy use lifestyles. So I think this all started when I realized that I was taking more from nature than I was really giving back, just in my lifestyle, which is the same as almost anyone's in North America, you know, watching TV, using the microwave, having a big fridge, having at least two computers in the house, a car, you know, all these things that just consume a lot of energy, whether it's electricity or petroleum. And personally, I just started feeling like, you know, where's the nature in my lifestyle? My life wouldn't be possible without nature, so how come I'm taking so much from it? It's a pretty heavy feeling and idea, and it's not the kind of worry or negativity that I would want to pass on as a message. So I was thinking, you know, what I'd really like to do is write a really lighthearted children's piece of fiction in a graphic novel format so that the pictures can convey a lot of humor and information that basically talks about our need to be connected with nature and see how to live more sustainably with it.
Now, it revolves around a 12-year-old, Luce, yes, who kind of walks, hardly thrilled about the prospect of having to, say, actually walk to the mall, because there's changes, there's power outages, and gasoline prices are going up, and obviously mm-hmm. it's just... Tell us, how did you come about creating this particular character?
Well, I don't know if this goes for most writers, but I think a lot of people write a little bit about themselves in characters. So... Luce, I'll just hold it up for the camera here. Luce is a Latina girl, as I am, and she's just a 12-year-old who likes her lifestyle. You know, she likes eating chocolate and having ice creams with her best friend and going to the mall with her mom to buy some imported shoes that she's been saving up her cat sitting money for. And so I can relate to that kind of, you know, I guess earthly pleasures of chocolate and ice cream and shopping for things that you like. So I put that into this character, but I also put the sort of suddenly seeing what's really important in life, and it isn't those things. It's community and it's family and it's being connected with nature. That's what's important to me, and that's what Luce figures out also, which is why I also chose to title the book Luce Sees the Light. Her name, which is a Spanish name meaning light. The English version is Lucy. Lucy also means light. So in Spanish, Luce means light, and she sees the light. So it's a little play on words.
So tell us a little bit, while I'm giving away all the endings and everything, to give us a little sense of the plot here. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously things are changing suddenly. She can't do everything that she wants to do, and she sort of tries to organize, I guess, is maybe a mm-hmm. good word. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, there's one aspect in the story. There are several little sort of subplots. And one is that she lives in a neighborhood that has no parks. It's sort of a small city, not any particular city. And she has nowhere to kind of go and hang out and be with friends. But there is an old abandoned lot around the corner, and it's just full of garbage. It has an old couch. It has pizza slices with rats eating it. And it's just kind of gross. So she, after she realizes that going to the mall isn't so much an option anymore for various reasons, because there are blackouts in the city and because her mom doesn't want to drive her anymore because gas prices are too high. She decides, let's do something in the neighborhood. So she mounts a campaign to turn this abandoned lot full of garbage into a community park with a playground, with a stage for local bands to play, and also with community gardens so people can have little raised boxes to grow their own vegetables instead of relying on imported foods as well. So she faces a lot of adversity in this effort. Her friends think she's crazy. They think, like, you know, we've got supermarkets, we don't have to make our own food. Her neighbors don't like canvassers, so they just shut the door on her when she asks her neighbors for help. So even though it's really difficult, in the end, her friends realize it's more important to be friends to Luce than to judge what it is that she's doing. And in the end, they all come around and they get the help of the community to get the city permits to create this park and do all of the labor to get it happening. So in the end, it's a pretty fun endeavor.
Now, there's this other element that we referred to earlier, which is the graphic novel approach. Why did you decide to take that approach as opposed to, say, something that is not a graphic novel, that may be simpler to illustrate, certainly?
Yeah, for sure. At first, I wasn't sure what kind of format to do. I've illustrated, you know, over a dozen children's books, nonfiction children's books, and so illustrating is definitely what I like to do. This is the first time I've written a book. This is my first authored book, and I wanted to write and illustrate it. So I could have done a chapter book with spot illustrations here and there, or I could have done a picture book with more information. But having it in a graphic novel format is almost like watching TV in a book, and I think kids might really enjoy that aspect. You can move along quickly from panel to panel or more slowly. You can really show kids' expressions and how they feel without using words. And in fact, this book started out as a webcomic, so I wanted to originally get this story online in a free format so that people could just go week to week and see what unfolds in the story. And eventually that got picked up by my publisher to turn it into a real book.
Anyway, as I noticed, particularly, certainly from what I've seen online and the book certainly you have there, the colors in this thing are really vivid. I mean, how did you come about choosing the kinds of colors that you do? I mean,
are you talking about the inside?
Yeah, or the inside. Well, that's true. That is true. It is brown on the inside, but
the cover is
yeah.
Well, this is actually a full color book, but I chose to just limit it to two tones. So, cream paper, black, and then a brown. This is the first book in a series, and each book is going to have a different color scheme to represent a little bit what the topic is like. So brown, I thought, was a nice color just to kind of, I guess, focus on the earthiness of the topic. The next book is about water, so the colors are blue. So it's blue, black, and beige. But the cover is always full color so that it stands out and I can do a more well-rounded portrayal of the character.
Now, you said, by the way, a moment ago that it's not any particular town.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any sense about where this town is, I mean, in the world? Or is it, I mean, I have not read the book, so I don't have any sense about if there are any small indicators one way or the other.
Well, personally, when I draw parts of this town, I do literally refer to parts in my neighborhood, and I'm from Toronto. And Toronto is a very big city. You would not be able to just easily get a permit to turn an abandoned lot into a garden, for example. But I imagine it would be easier in a small town. So this could just be any town or small city in North America, basically. But it's pretty generic enough that hopefully the book will be translated throughout the world and apply to any country, I'm hoping.
And by the way, and now the character, as you said, is Latina. Was there some purpose behind that, or was it just simply a self-identification for you? What were you thinking when talking about sort of as moving from one to the other? I mean,
I think I didn't think about it. it just kind of happened naturally. I I don't really see very many Latina characters, really. Like female characters a little bit, but Latina female characters who aren't just, I don't know, comedy or movie stars or something. So it just seemed like a fresh new way of showing a heroine, and it didn't feel like I was trying too hard because I myself am Latina, so it just came naturally.
And now you're from Chile, is that right?
That's right. I'm from Chile.
From I guess when you left in 1973, is that right?
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
We came to Canada in 1973.
I guess that was after the. I guess it was a coup.
It was because of the coup.
Yeah. I used to work with a few people who did the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, well, why don't you read a little bit about? Why don't you read or describe and read as a little from your book there?
Sure. So this selection is. When Luz and her mom go shopping, and a lot of things are happening. There are blackouts that are starting to happen, but also gas prices are going up. And I'm pretty sure that people are feeling that here in Maryland as well. But this happens slightly in the future, where gas prices are even higher than they are now. So there's Luz just, you know, fantasizing about chocolate cookies. So here she is in the first panel, and she's just going, chocolate cookies. And then her mom says, Luz, wake up, chica, time to go. What's with all the weird groceries? Where are our avocados and pineapples? And no rice and beans? Those cost too much now, probably because they come from far away. With gas prices so high, it's cheaper to buy local stuff. And her mom says, farms nearby grow different foods like tomatoes, lettuce, and zucchini. And they make cheese and bread and... Rabbit? Is that actually rabbit meat? Says Luz. I am not eating that. No way. Nuh-uh. Later in the car, Luz says, Mom, we forgot to get the chalky cookies. Those come from China. I just told you imported stuff is costing too much. Then there should be a chalky factory here. And her mom says, Dream on. Importing stuff has been cheaper than making it here. Until now. How come, Mom? And now we start getting explanatory. Other countries pay their workers less or use cheaper materials, that sort of thing. So what happens now? What happens, Luz, is we've got to change the way we shop. I'll just read one more page on that. And then in this page, I do an illustrated example of imported foods. Oil is running out and getting very expensive, so now it costs more to import goods than it used to. If we keep relying on imports, eventually we won't be able to afford the things we need. So we should buy from local farms and businesses and produce stuff on our own. Plus, if farms and factories were closer to our stores, they'd use less gas to deliver their goods. So things would become more affordable. The same should be true in other countries. And they could actually eat what they grow instead of selling it all to us. And Luz says, and less transportation means less pollution too, right? Actually, that's true. Looks like you're starting to pay attention. And then they ran out of gas.
We're talking to Claudia Davila. She's the author of Luz Sees the Light, and it's a graphic novel of children's fiction. Ernie, and I guess there were a couple of other books as well, I guess, that won awards. Riparia's River and The Mangrove Tree. Just briefly, can you describe what those were like or what it was about?
Sure. The Mangrove Tree book by Susan Roth and Cindy Trembor is about a project in Eritrea where a scientist named Dr. Sato from the U.S. had gone to Eritrea and gotten the community to get interested in this project about replanting mangrove trees on the coast of Eritrea. And it worked beautifully there because the leaves and the branches from the mangrove trees then fed the cattle who, because of the drought there, weren't getting enough food. It helped out with the local fishers because there was a place for all of the local seafood to hatch and to grow. And so the whole community got involved, and it worked beautifully. It's a children's nonfiction book that's illustrated with collage. And all of the illustrations from the book are at the Ward Museum right now in an exhibit entitled Art, Literature, and the Environment. Beautiful exhibit. So if you want to see the original collage art from the book, you can go to the Ward Museum and see it until early June. What else? Arthur Turns Green, mm-hmm. By Mark Brown. People are probably familiar with the Arthur series. Mark Brown hadn't done one of these for probably 7-8 years, and he was inspired to write a new Arthur book about Arthur making an effort to be part of environmental stewardship to help the Earth become a better place. So he created a book, and he wasn't able to attend the award ceremony, but he accepted his award via video, which was great for the kids in the audience who all grew up with the Arthur series on PBS, and so that was good. Riparia's River was an honor book in the children's picture book category by Michael Caduto. That one's about children making the effort to clean up a river which has become polluted. Let's see, what were the other?
I think we got it.
That's
about it. And look, I want to thank our guests here, Ernie Bond. He's Associate Professor of Education, Salisbury University. Also author Caitlin Vernon, author of Nowhere Else on Earth, Standing Tall for the Great Bear Rainforest. And Claudia Davida, who is author of the graphic novel, Luce Sees the Light. It's a graphic novel for children. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on Pack 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pack14.org.